This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome to Navarra Live. I'm Michael Walker, and on his first Navarra Live co-hosting, I'm joined by Tyke Hickey. Tyke, how are you doing?
How are you doing, Michael? Thanks for having me, buddy.
Real pleasure to have you on. Now, I'm sure many of our audience are going to be thinking, oh, it's that guy who does those brilliant skits on X or TikTok or Instagram or wherever you prefer to watch your comedy. In case you haven't, I thought we'd start the show by showing you one of Tyke's recent sketches.
Housing disputes. Oh my God. Are you two still squabbling? Christ, I thought you'd have sorted it out amongst yourselves by now.
Squabbling?
He turned up at my house one day and kicked me out, claiming it was his.
It's true, though. This is my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-granddad's house, I think.
He forced me to live in the shed, and when I fought back, he wiped out my entire family. And now he's trying to blow the shed up with me in it. Not true. I told you, if you leave the shed quietly and pitch a tent next door, I probably won't kill you.
Okay, I've heard enough, yeah. Let me think, see if I can sort this out for you. Okay, you were living here. He came along. Get out of the house. Stuck you in the shed. Killed your whole family. Nah. Beats me.
It's complicated, isn't it?
It really is.
It's a right Rubik's Cube.
Am I here? Like, can you hear me when I'm talking?
I think the best we can do, really, is give you more explosives to blow the shed up anyway, first and foremost.
Well, I gotta defend myself.
Now, be careful with them. You hear me? Yeah, minimise damage. Be surgical.
Be surgical blowing up a shed.
All right, calm down. He's very volatile, isn't he? You get something too. All good?
Now, it's a very dark form of humour, but Tyke, I think in about 90 seconds there, you summarised a lot of what we've been talking about on this show for the past 6 months. Tell me how did you get into political comedy?
Yeah, I was in a sketch group for years that was doing kind of like surreal stuff, and we were getting far enough, but around the time of COVID, when the world just seemed to kind of implode, I used that as an opportunity to just do the type of comedy that I always wanted to do, which was political stuff. I was kind of taking the mick out of the British Empire. I mean, there's obviously a lot of material there. And I felt like the world is ending, so just do what you like. So that's what I just did. I just had a camera and I started messing around with some sketches on my own, playing all the characters, just pulling out some wigs from the attic. And yeah, to my great, great surprise, there's a massive audience there for geopolitical house share comedy, because that's effectively the little niche that I've made for myself. So yeah.
You've created your own genre. Lots of very positive comments coming in the chats. Lots of people who didn't need to show me that skit before they knew what your comedy was like. And let's get straight into the show, though. Coming up later tonight, we speak to a climate scientist about extraordinary flooding occurring in Dubai. Gordon Ramsay's restaurant has been hit by squatters. And we look at free speech in Europe after Yanis Varoufakis has been banned from Germany. Stay tuned for all of that. Straight into our first story. Thanks for the advice, but we'll make our own decisions. That was the message from Netanyahu after the foreign secretaries of both the UK and Germany made visits to Israel. Speaking after a private meeting with Netanyahu in Jerusalem, David Cameron said this.
The situation is very concerning. It's right to show solidarity with Israel. It's right to have made our views clear about what should happen next. But it's clear the Israelis are making a decision to act. We hope they do so in a way that does as little to escalate this as possible, and in a way that, as I said yesterday, is smart as well as tough.
Now, this is another one of those situations where if we really wanted to have some influence over the Israelis, maybe we would condition our weapons, right? Maybe we wouldn't just say, oh, can you try not respond in an escalatory way? Remember, this is a country that bombed the consulate of a foreign country just 2 weeks ago. That's why we're in this situation here. That is perhaps, though, the clearest confirmation we've had yet from a senior politician that Israel is now gearing up to respond to Iran's retaliatory attack that took place on Saturday. And Iran appears to be taking the threat very seriously, anticipating a potential strike on Iran-controlled areas of Syria. The Iranian Revolutionary Guards have granted leave to all commanders of the militias it backs in Iran-controlled areas of Syria. That's according to a report by Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. And in Iran, the country has been celebrating its strike on Israel. Billboards in Tehran have been erected memorializing the attack, the first ever military action by Iran against Israel conducted from its own territory. The country has also been flashing its military might, celebrating National Army Day with a large-scale parade advertising its defense preparedness. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has issued this warning to Israel and its allies. "This operation showed that our armed forces are ready. We firmly declare that the slightest action against Iran's interests will definitely be met with a severe, extensive, and painful response." Israel's allies have made clear that they don't want to take part in any war with Iran. Instead, they're imposing new sanctions. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan has released this statement. "In the coming days, the United States will impose new sanctions targeting Iran, including its missiles and drone program, as well as new sanctions against entities supporting the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and Iran's defense ministry. We anticipate that our allies and partners will soon be following with their own sanctions. The pressure will continue. We will not hesitate to continue to take action in coordination with allies and partners around the world and with Congress to hold the Iranian government accountable for its malicious and destabilizing actions." Given that Iran is already under an almost complete economic embargo by the US, as well as a total arms ban, it's hard to imagine Tehran is going to be much affected by this new announcement. And experts have warned that any further economic sanctions will have to involve taking action against Chinese banks, institutions they are through which Tehran sells much of its oil. Now, that's likely to be a step too far for the Americans because it risks US relations with China while also removing around 1.5 million barrels of oil per day from global markets. Bob McNally of consultancy firm Rapidian Energy Group told the Washington Post this: "The last thing Biden wants is higher gas prices, so he wants Iran selling its oil to China. He does not want that oil to be shut in. It's as simple as that. He can't afford to sanction Iran's oil. They could do some symbolic stuff to go after a little trader here or there, but that's likely about it." Despite the largely performative nature of these sanction threats, Cameron echoed the United States strategy in Jerusalem.
"Well, we want to see coordinated sanctions against Iran. Britain has in many ways led the way with our new sanctions regime, sanctioning dozens of people in Iran, sanctioning the IRGC in its entirety. And I think there's more that we can do to show united front that Iran is behind so much of the malign activity in this region, backing Hamas, backing Hezbollah, backing the Houthis. They need to be given a clear and unequivocal message by the G7. And I hope that will happen at the meeting."
So David Cameron has urged Israel to act with restraint, and so has key Israel ally, Germany. German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock asked Benjamin Netanyahu to act, quote, prudently and responsibly, in response to the advice of the two foreign ministers. So German and British, Netanyahu said this: "They have all sorts of suggestions and advice. I appreciate that, but I want to make it clear we will make our own decisions and the state of Israel will do everything necessary to defend itself. So thank you for the weapons, thank you for the advice, but we'll do what we want." Tig, we're in an interesting situation here, I think, because essentially it seems to me as if the Western powers, so the United States, Britain, Germany, etc., they don't want a war with Iran, right? I mean, it's an election year in the United States for a start, but also it'd be incredibly damaging for, you know, many, many people, many, many countries. Israel, though, seems to be, you know, more willing to have one because it wants to draw America into a war with Iran. It has done for sort of 20 years or so. And so there's a strange situation going on here whereby, I suppose, Netanyahu, if he were to attack Iran, is thinking, well, even if they don't want me to attack Iran, if Iran then fights back against us, you know, Biden, even if he doesn't really want to, will have no choice but to defend us. So there's a sort of strange sort of standoff. It feels a little bit like poker where sort of everyone's trying to guess their next moves. What do you see as, you know, I don't want to ask you for predictions, but what do you see as sort of the nature of what we're looking at right now?
Well, I think the whole way through this so-called war, it felt like Israel is doing stuff and seeing how far I can get away with. Like, the whole way through, you feel like there's no way we'll get away with 10,000 murders. There's no way we'll get away with bombing every mosque and academic institution and effectively starving a population. And with each passing month, I think it's almost surprising itself just how little control the West has over it. So I feel this move towards Iran is twofold. There's two things going on. One, I think Netanyahu at this point is going, I mean, I'm going to lose my job at the end of this war, so I'm just having a good time. I feel like the man is, you know, probably a psychopath or whatever, but he is literally sticking two fingers up to the West and he's pushing it further and further. I mean, to retaliate to Iran and declaring that he's going to do it, and for Cameron to basically say, look, we've had a stern word, but he's out of control. He's a crazy guy. I mean, it's shocking that the West is proving itself to be so limp with regard to Israel. But the other thing that it's doing, I think, from Israel's perspective, is it's taking the focus off Gaza, which is good because they know they've lost, of course, they've lost the moral argument completely with regard to Palestine. So to create a new kind of baddie in Iran is really good because it gets the Americans and the British to kind of put out that Rocky Five type mentality again, that we're the good guys and here are the bad guys. So we need to rally around our ally. But yeah, I mean, it's scary times. I think an interesting thing in the Guardian was the UK effectively saying if the onus goes off Israel's focus on Hamas and it goes on to Iran, we're worried that Israel won't stick to its recommendations of letting more aid in, which is effectively Britain saying, if we don't keep an eye on our ally, who's like a really good guy, he's going to go back and do some more genocide. So I think that's the most damning declaration of the West's true feelings about Israel.
It's very strange, isn't it, saying we're having a tough word with them to try and get them to do less war crimes, but also we're still giving them weapons. Yeah, it doesn't quite add up. It's not quite a coherent position. You were saying there, which I think is absolutely right, Israel might want a war with Iran because it would sort of take world attention off Gaza and then they can sort of achieve their maximalist aims there. The war in Gaza and any conflagration with Iran also takes attention from what's going on in occupied Jerusalem. So in terms of a longer-term solution in the Middle East, all the Western powers claim to be committed to a two-state solution. But a new report from The Guardian shows that Israel is continuing its project to make that impossible. So under the cover of its war on Gaza, Israel has been speeding up the building of settlements in occupied East Jerusalem. East Jerusalem was illegally annexed by Israel in 1980, and the government has allowed Jewish Israeli settlers to move into the Palestinian territory ever since, with around 220,000 now living there. But since October the 7th, the government has accelerated the building of more than 20 new projects involving thousands of additional housing units as permanent settlements in occupied territory. All of them are illegal under international law. Sari Kronish of human rights organisation BIMCOM told The Guardian this: the fast-tracking of these plans has been unparalleled in the last 6 months. While many government bodies were shattered or had limited operation following 7th of October, the planning authorities continued to plough forward, advancing these plans at unprecedented speed. Some of the newly approved plans appear to involve more than just the building of new homes, which would be bad enough. Amy Cohen of human rights NGO IR Amim said this: many of the settlement plans are strategically designated for areas along the southern perimeter of East Jerusalem. If constructed, they would further fracture the Palestinian space and create a sealing-off effect of East Jerusalem from Bethlehem and the southern West Bank. Such moves directly undermine conditions necessary for a viable independent Palestinian state with a contiguous capital in East Jerusalem. All this while bringing planning and building for Palestinians in the city to a complete stop. Tig, I suppose lots of your sketches, actually, I think, you know, in a very powerful way, sort of shine a light on the politics of essentially stealing people's homes. And this does seem to be sort of accelerating under the cover of this war on Gaza and then this increased tensions with Iran.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think most people are kind of cottoning on to the fact now that this war, so-called war, was never about Hamas. It was about accelerating ethnic cleansing and genocide that had been going on, I think, quite slowly up until this point. I mean, Israel was doing a really good job, in my opinion, of getting away with ethnic cleansing, genocide and apartheid. It was just doing it really slowly. It had the backing of all the Western powers. It wasn't claiming massive headlines of huge numbers killed. It would, to use its own horrific phrase, mow the lawn every few years in Gaza. But I think what's happened on October 7th is a kind of a bloodlust for revenge has kind of motivated them to try and accelerate the process. And if you're killing journalists and if you're killing academics and you're killing women and children and aid workers and frontline staff, then you're not in any way fighting a so-called terrorist organization. You're hoping to obliterate the population. But I suppose, like, as your show and other shows have mentioned, it's almost impossible to kill an idea. You know, it's to use our own Irish example here. I mean, there was 800 years of British colonialism trying to kill Irish resistance. And it just would go away for a while. You kill some of the fighters, but it comes back again because it's an idea, it's a passion, it's a desire for freedom, and that's impossible to kill. And I think the illustration of what's going on in the West Bank shows so clearly that this war, so-called war against Hamas, is a front for accelerating this process of just making a two-state or a one-state or Palestinian statehood or justice or liberation in any way impossible. And to be fair, Netanyahu's been really public and honest about that. He's stated from the outset that his almost political ambition, his number one political ambition, is to bury the idea of Palestinian statehood forever. But the irony is, I suppose, through their brutality, we're now seeing people all around the world who might have, I mean, even in my own city in Cork, I'm seeing people at marches every week. They've never been on a political march in their life. And they're all, I would say, you know, some people would say radicalized. I would say rationalized into being pro-Palestine. And they're not just going to be happy with the end of genocide, stopping a genocide. They're going to be going all the way towards liberation and justice. And it's a beautiful thing. So if Israel's desire was to stamp out Palestinian statehood and justice forever, it's been an absolutely massive strategic geopolitical blunder, because I think the world, rational people anyway in the world, are united in their pro-Palestinianism right now, which is one small, beautiful thing to come out of this absolute nightmare.
Now, I want to talk a bit more about attitudes towards Palestine in Ireland later in the show when we discuss Germany, which in terms of attitudes towards this conflict is probably the other pole of European nations in terms of how they look at the conflict. Well, I don't want to call it a conflict. I mean, it's barely a war. It's a genocidal assault. But what's going on, I mean, in Israel-Palestine? You've got the Germans there, the Irish there. So we'll talk about that later in the show. Now, though, let's go to a very different story. Extremely heavy rain in Gulf states has caused flash floods, which have led to the deaths of at least 20 people. The storms led to the flooding of Dubai's runways, which caused severe delays at the world's busiest airport, or the world's second busiest airport, sorry. And water reached waist height on some of the wealthy city's busiest roads. Dubai is in the United Arab Emirates, a small but rich country, which on Tuesday registered its largest rainfall event since records began 75 years ago. Incredibly, more than double the amount of rain expected in a whole year fell in just one single day. It was in neighboring Oman, though, where the rainfall was most deadly. 19 people there were killed since Sunday. So it's just one person, so far we know, was killed in the UAE. Earlier today, I spoke to climate scientist Ella Gilbert, and I began by asking her whether floods in the desert can be attributed to climate change.
Almost always we can point the finger of blame at climate change when we have unprecedented extreme events. Of course, it's very difficult to say with any degree of certainty whether any specific extreme weather event was related to climate change until you do a specific study to kind of attribute the fingerprint of blame on climate change. But we know that climate change is making much more unpredictable conditions. And it means that you're going to see many more extreme events, whether that's floods or droughts or wildfires or heat waves or any kind of extreme event. Those are more frequent and they are more extreme when they do happen as a result of human activity warming the climate.
I would assume that in that part of the world, it still will be droughts that they're most worried about compared to floods. You know, maybe you will get, you know, the odd extreme flood, which is more serious than it would have been in the past, but would we still expect sort of droughts in, you know, close to the equator to be the biggest problem people will be facing?
Sure, I guess it sort of depends more on what we're used to. So, for example, a 40 degree heat wave in India is not going to have the same effect as a 40 degree heat wave that hit the UK a couple of years ago. I think we can all relate to the fact that that was completely out of our experience, not something that we're set up for. And in the same sort of way, if you have an extreme event that is completely not what you're used to, not what you are prepared for, whether that's a flood in the desert or a 40 degree heat wave in the UK, it's basically about what you're adapted to, what your infrastructure is ready for, what you are used to, and what is considered normal. So extreme events can, the same extreme event could have a very different impact depending on where it hits.
The United Arab Emirates is a very high-tech society, and they're known to do something called cloud seeding. Now, rightly or wrongly, some people have suggested that maybe these floods were caused by cloud seeding. So I was wondering, could I get you to first explain what cloud seeding is, and then to give your assessment as to whether this could have anything to do with these floods?
So cloud seeding is a technique that is used essentially to initiate precipitation. So it basically adds some little particles into clouds. And the theory goes that this sort of causes atmospheric water vapor to crystallize on those seeds, and then that triggers rainfall. It can be used in places that are particularly dry that are being used for agriculture, for instance. It was used a lot in the Soviet Union, and they use it in the Midwest of the US. But it has a kind of dubious record. It's quite hard to test whether that cloud would have rained anyway, with or without the cloud seeding. So it's not necessarily a dead cert. It's used quite a lot in the UAE, but it seems very unlikely that cloud seeding could be responsible for the deluges that we're seeing in Dubai at the moment. And in fact, there are lots of people who work on this much more than I do that have said pretty conclusively that it's completely ridiculous to suggest that cloud seeding is responsible. This is a clear kind of indication of climate change. The magnitude of the event that we saw is much more likely to be associated with human-caused climate heating than it is to be with cloud seeding.
Let's talk about a potentially bigger climate story, definitely one that's going to affect more people. So we had you on a lot last year when we had those record-breaking temperatures, not usually in the United Kingdom, but sort of there were global temperatures which broke a lot of records. Now that we always said, or you always said, that was partly because of a long-term process, which is climate change, and also a cyclical process, which is El Nino, sort of the natural phase that the globe goes into where it becomes warmer, and La Nina being the opposite, where it becomes cooler. Now, as far as I understand it, El Nino has ended a bit sooner than people expected. Could you talk about the significance of that and what that might mean for everyone?
Yeah, so El Nino basically turbocharges global temperatures, which is why we've seen those crazy heat waves, those crazy records that we had last year, and why, you know, even up till March. March was the 10th consecutive month that was the hottest month on record for that particular month. So it's not like it's gone away very quickly. El Nino usually lasts between 9 and 12 months. It started last July, so that makes it about 9 months. So it's on the short side. It's not necessarily finishing sooner, a lot sooner than people expected. I think scientists probably would have predicted it would finish around about spring, which according to my notes is probably about now. I think it doesn't necessarily make a huge difference in terms of these sorts of extremes and records that we're seeing, because underlying all of these records, of course, is the background trend of climate change. Climate change is the thing that's really fueling the records to be broken. It's fueling the extreme events that we're seeing. El Nino kind of adds a little bit of extra spice into the mix, but it doesn't necessarily drive them alone. So even though the El Nino is now transitioning into a neutral, and eventually by the end of the year, it'll be in more of a La Nina phase, which is its opposite phase. I think we'll still continue to see some extremes, maybe not quite so extreme as last year, but over the coming years, I'm sure we'll be going back to record-breaking conditions again.
We sort of had a false start to spring. First of all, an apology, because I shouldn't really ask you about the weather because you're a climate scientist. But I've got this nagging fear that while the rest of the world heats up, which is obviously bad, you know, if you're already in a hot country, you don't want it to get any hotter, that there's something about Britain which means that we're just going to remain damp and cold. I don't know, the jet stream or something. Is it, am I being overly worried here? Or I suppose maybe we don't want England to get that much hotter, but are we going to just be this cold island off of mainland Europe, or am I overthinking a short cold spell?
Oh, so many thoughts on this. Well, it's, first of all, it's okay because I am a trained meteorologist. You are allowed to ask me about the weather. The thing about climate change is that it intensifies the weather. It also, as well as making temperatures on the whole hotter, it makes the atmosphere wetter. So for every degree of warming that we have, we get 7% more water vapor in the atmosphere, which means for a fairly rainy place like the UK that we get more rain. And specifically, we get more like intense downpours in the summer and we get milder, wetter winters. So less of those nice, crispy, snowy days and much more of that horrible, miserable, wet, damp winter that we all love so much. So unfortunately for the UK, it's likely that we're going to see more of that kind of wet conditions. And in fact, the last 18 months were the wettest 18 months for the UK ever on record. So it seems like this is the kind of thing that we can expect more of, as well as in the summer, likely to be more of those extreme hot days.
That was climate scientist Ella Gilbert speaking to me earlier today. Go out and buy a high-quality waterproof jacket. That's my advice. Next story. It's been a busy week for free speech, or the lack of it. Last Friday, the Free Day Palestine Congress opened in Berlin. The conference was intended to be a venue where around 250 participants could discuss Israel's war on Gaza, with a particular focus on Germany's military support for the rogue state. Invited speakers included former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis and British Palestinian surgeon Ghassan Abu Sitta. But this was the moment that German police shut it down less than an hour after it started.
Russia needs to get food. Mosques, churches, universities, cemeteries, bakeries, apartment
buildings. Shame on you! Shame on you! Shame on you!
The police is standing right in front of us and they ask us to stop the video.
Everyone keep calm, please. Don't give them any reason to be violent.
Their explanations as to why have been somewhat vague. So explaining their action, the Berlin police said this. At the Palestine Congress, a speaker was connected who is banned from political activity. There is a risk that a speaker who has made anti-Semitic or violence glorifying public statements in the past will be called in repeatedly. Therefore, the meeting was terminated and a ban was also imposed for Saturday and Sunday. Now, it's unclear who exactly they were concerned about, but the ban hit some high-profile people. Here's what Ghassan Abu Sitta experienced.
So this morning at 10 o'clock, I landed in Berlin to attend a conference on Palestine, where I had been asked, along with many others in the UK, in the United States, and in Europe, to give my evidence of the 43 days that I had seen in the hospitals in Gaza, working in both Shifa and Al-Ahli Hospital. Upon arrival, I was stopped at the passport office. I was then escorted down to the basement of the airport, where I was questioned for around 3.5 hours. At the end of 3.5 hours, I was told that I will not be allowed to enter German soil, that I will, and that this ban will last the whole of April. And not just that, that if I were to try to set to link up by Zoom, or FaceTime with the conference, even if I was outside Germany, or I were to send a video of my lecture to the conference in Berlin, then that would constitute a breach of German law and that I would endanger myself to having a fine or even up to a year of prison. I then was asked at the end to book a flight back to the UK. My passport was taken away from me, and then I only got my passport back as I was boarding the plane.
Yanis Varoufakis also found himself in Germany's bad books.
Do you know that the German Interior Ministry has just issued me with a ban? I've been banned from entering Germany. And indeed, if that were not enough, I've been banned from talking to you via Zoom, or indeed through a video message like this. The threat being that if I dare do it, exactly what I'm doing now, that I will be tried in Germany for breaking German law. Why? Because of a speech that I published yesterday on my blog, calling for universal human rights in Israel-Palestine, a speech that I was banned from delivering in the Palestine Congress in Berlin, which the police, in its infinite wisdom, entered the venue and violently disbanded.
Speaking to Democracy Now!, Varoufakis gave this explanation for Germany's worrying reaction to the Congress.
They do not want a Congress like ours, especially one that includes progressive Jews. That is the main thing that they detested, that they were Jewish demonstrators, Jewish activists, Jewish intellectuals, Jewish speakers with us, with one voice saying one thing alone: equal political rights, civil liberties from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. I'm neither a Jew nor a Palestinian. I don't have a view as to how this will be accomplished. But I think every single human person on this planet has an obligation, not a right, an obligation to demand from the river to the sea equal political rights. And the German political establishment does not want to listen to this. They simply want to associate anyone who opposes Netanyahu's government or any government in Israel that perpetrates genocide, essentially, to be associated, to be stigmatized as an anti-Semite, which, by the way, it is the anti-Semites' greatest dream come true.
The shutdown of the Congress is just the latest in Germany's clampdown on pro-Palestinian speech. German police have frequently used heavy-handed and violent tactics against peaceful pro-Palestinian protesters, and various regional governments have banned or suppressed protests since October 7th, often labelling them anti-Semitic. In Berlin, using the phrase "from the river to the sea" is currently a crime. That's led to the arrest of activists, including for simply carrying signs. But it's not just Germany that shut down a conference in recent days. In Belgium this week, this happened.
I'm not going to stay when the police storm the place and get everybody out. I'm not going to get involved in the fight. But they will be closing this down this afternoon. They have a closure order. The police have it already.
That was Nigel Farage leaving the National Conservatism Conference in Brussels on Tuesday after the city's mayor ordered the police to shut it down, labelling it, quote, far right. Now, unlike in Germany when the Palestine Congress got shuttered, reaction to the closing of a right-wing talking shop came thick and fast. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak called the action, quote, extremely disturbing. And Suella Braverman, who was due to speak at the conference, said this.
It's a real shame that the thought police, instructed by the mayor of Brussels, saw fit to try and undermine and denigrate what is free speech and free debate. I remember the words of Mrs. Thatcher, and I'm going to misquote her, but the more ridiculous and far-fetched and extremist their attempts are to silence us, the more cheered on I am, because it just shows that they've lost the political argument.
You could equally say that about Suella Braverman calling the pro-Palestine marches hate marches and trying to get them banned. Maybe that was because she'd lost that argument, right? Hungary's right-wing president Viktor Orban was also due to speak at that conference. He said this: the Belgian police decided to shut down the National Conservative Conference in Brussels just 2 hours after it started. I guess they couldn't take free speech any longer. The last time they wanted to silence me with the police was when the communists set them on me in 1988. We didn't give up then, and we will not give up this time either. And, well, there's crazy hashtags. Hashtag no migration. Hashtag no gender. Hashtag no war. Interesting conflagration of negations there, I suppose. Both Braverman and Orban have been responsible for shutting down freedom of speech in their respective countries. In the UK, Braverman oversaw bills that clamped down on legitimate protests. She was also incredibly aggressive when it came to the pro-Palestine demonstrations. And in Hungary, Orban has severely restricted press and media freedom. So we can assume none of these people really care about speech being free. But someone who does is Yanis Varoufakis. In an interview for Unheard, he said this: I'm no political friend of Nigel Farage, but I would hate it if anyone like Nigel was prevented from speaking merely because he may say things that may annoy, among other people, myself, Unless we return to basic liberal values and stop wanting to be triggered by the arguments of our opponents, we stand no chance of navigating a decent course through the various landmines of authoritarianism. The NatCon conference was up and running again today, so they've had a much easier ride than the pro-Palestinians. They were shut down for a day. The Palestine Congress, you know, has been banned, and people have been banned from doing anything political in Germany. But we have heard more about the cancelling of the NatCon conference. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be consistent, though. I don't think either of them should have been shut down. Tig, what do you make of these two situations?
I am like you insofar as I don't think anything should be shut down. The moment that you cancel something, I think, now within reason, like if the event is a direct threat to other human beings, I think all sensible people would agree that that's best to cancel. But the idea of cancelling something, I think, generally speaking, is not a good idea because it just makes the thing way more interesting. So I actually would agree with Yanis there in his assessment. But I do think it's interesting that the right only ever has a problem with cancelling when they're getting cancelled. Like, they've got no problem whatsoever with murky lefties like us getting cancelled left, right and centre.
To be fair, I think you see a fair amount of opportunistic support for cancelling on both sides, I would hazard to say. Although I do think, you know, it's clear from our political establishment that there has been much more noise about the NatCon conference than there has been about the Palestine Congress. As I say, even though the Palestine Congress, its repression was much more severe. McCarthyism about pro-Palestinian viewpoints isn't just finding expression in Germany. In the US, your position on Palestinian resistance can put your job at risk. Jody Dean is a leading American political theorist and is a tenured professor at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in New York State. The idea of tenure is to give you the freedom to say what you want without risking your job. The whole point of it is to protect academic free speech. But Dean has apparently found a limit to that. In an article for Verso last week titled Palestine Speaks for Everyone, Dean argued that the narrative around October the 7th has been designed to conceal the liberatory nature of Hamas's action. And in it, Dean writes this: defending Hamas, we take the side of the Palestinian resistance responding to a revolutionary subject, the subject fighting against occupation and oppression, and recognizing this subject as an effect of a contested and open process. Which side are you on? Liberation or Zionism and imperialism? There are two sides and no alternative, no negotiation of the relation between oppressor and oppressed. Now, you may not agree with that statement. Personally, I don't agree with Dean's article. But Jody Dean's First Amendment rights guarantee her the freedom to say it. Never mind, though, because her employer found a way around them. And so Jody Dean has been suspended from teaching, after which the university said this: Hobart and William Smith Colleges deeply believe in and supports free speech and academic freedom. It is a tenet of our work. This means that Professor Dean has the right to express her views, just as others have the right to find those views reprehensible and to condemn them. However, Hobart and William Smith also has an obligation, as do all colleges and universities in the United States, under federal anti-discrimination laws, including Title VI, to take action when we know or should know of a hostile environment based on national origin. This is the law, and we fully abide by it. According to Jody Dean, the university has offered no explanation for how her essay has created a hostile environment. Tig, what do you think of this particular controversy?
Well, I actually feel like her article is pretty accurate, to be honest. I kind of like the idea of the oppressed and the oppressor. It feels like Israel right now is a laboratory for whether you want to believe that there is just two sides and you've got to take sides and that there is no space in the middle. So I feel like it's increasingly difficult for somebody who would see themselves as on the left in Israel. And like Gideon Levy and other people have pointed out, that leftism in Israel doesn't ever consider the occupation. So you could be socially liberal, you could be, you know, pro-LGBTQ plus, for instance, but the occupation is kind of the unmentionable. And I feel like the thrust of her argument is effectively that there's kind of no standing on the sidelines. You've got to take sides. And the resistance is, I think, an important... And I think it's a beautiful thing, and I might get into trouble for saying that, but like resistance, it's enshrined in international law. Every oppressed group of people since the beginning of modern history has has had to resist in some form, and it can be obviously cultural, but it can be militarily resistance as well. And it's enshrined in international law, and that's the nature of it. I think people can be, you know, you can obviously condemn any armed group that commits atrocities, and I think most reasonable people would do that. But the idea of resistance itself is the fundamental right of oppressed peoples. So I kind of feel that the article is reasonable. The means of kind of getting her cancelled just seem very familiar. Like, I feel like you get it as well with big tech at the moment, just finding more and more ludicrous ways to silence pro-Palestinian voices. And I think as the months are going on, it's getting to be more and more absurd, the means in which people, the lengths to which people are going to just silence any criticism whatsoever. And to go back to our earlier point in censorship, if you're going out of your way, you know, logically and economically and other ways to actually censor opposing voices, I think that's a clear indication that those voices are saying things that are really startlingly true.
I suppose my position in terms of international law, an occupied group does have the right to armed resistance, which absolutely the Palestinians have. But within that, you're not supposed to do stuff such as target civilians, which Hamas clearly also did on October the 7th. So, I mean, that's why I don't really endorse Jody Dean's piece. Of course, though, I don't think she should have been suspended from teaching. I was thinking about this because clearly, you know, the implication of the statement from the college is that because she said that she thinks it was an act of resistance that should be celebrated, what Hamas did, including the killing of Israeli civilians, then that would mean that, you know, Israelis, or I'm not sure if they would have included just Jews in general in her class, might have felt threatened or that they would be subject to discrimination. Now, I was wondering if they would have, you know, said the same thing about someone who was really gung-ho in favor of the Iraq war. You know, so if you'd had someone, you know, a lecturer who had said the war on Iraq is absolutely necessary, even if it kills a bunch of civilians, this is important to protect America against terrorism, right? Was there any professor who said that? I'd imagine that's probably a fairly common position for a neoconservative in the United States. Were there any professors who lost their teaching roles in case there was an Iraqi person in the class? Now, I imagine not. I haven't done the research on this, but I imagine not. I haven't heard of any sort of pro-Western war academic getting suspended from teaching because there might be someone in the classroom who is, you know, shares the identity of the people who were subject to that imperial war. So, I mean, maybe that's what she'll be arguing with the dean there. Before we move on, Tyke, I did want to sort of take advantage of having you on the show to talk about the relationship between Ireland and Palestine. And I suppose the comparison being that we've seen in Germany, there's just this enormous censorship. But also, I mean, it does seem like it's not purely top down. It does seem that there is a culture in Germany of support for Israel. There's clearly a culture in Ireland of support for Palestine. And I was wondering if you could, you know, talk about why you think that is. But also, and this is something I'm sort of interested in, what's the demand at the Palestine protests in Ireland? Because, you know, from our perspective, we just see what the Irish government says, and compared to our government, it doesn't seem too bad. So I was wondering what people are demanding of the Irish government in Ireland.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think in the quick one on the German example as well, for what it's worth, I get like so many messages from people in Germany. At the start of the war, I had many messages from people within the occupied territories who are Palestinian saying, I really love your sketches, but I can't even like them because I'd be afraid of what would happen. And actually, increasingly, those messages are coming from people in Germany. It's mad. From the US and Germany, mostly. And German friends here, and I'm sure you're talking to people all the time, to criticize Israel at all is just, it's just not the done thing at all. It feels like it's a country that's almost willing to sacrifice itself on the altar of war guilt. That's really how it feels at the moment. But I think like the Irish example is just so different because we've obviously not got this war guilt. We've not got the Holocaust hanging in the background. And we look at things differently, I think, because, you know, we're oppressed, like, and without, you know, we're not looking for any attention or anyone to come in and save us at this point. Like, but we have the colonial experience in our bones, in our DNA. I mean, people in the north of the country are still feeling the effects of British imperialism right up to today. So it's not something that's ancient. And I think the Palestinian experience just rings so familiar to us. It chimes really familiarly. The idea of dehumanizing the population so that you can brutalize them. I mean, that's completely, you know, British colonial playbook, being labeled as terrorists for resisting. And again, I just definitely would like to clarify, I'm not okay with the killing of innocent people at all. But the idea of resistance itself is a very familiar tool of oppressed people. And I think that's why the Irish and the Palestinians understand each other so well. So I think even in the south of Ireland, which is obviously quite different to the north, we don't have that immediate understanding of the colonial experience as much. But it's the Palestinian solidarity that's always been kind of there and nascent has developed into this really strong, beautiful thing. And it's now become symbiotic, where it's reawakening Irish understanding of its own culture and history and all that stuff as well. So it's a beautiful to and fro between them. And to answer your question about the marches, so the primary march chant is about an end to the ceasefire, or is about a ceasefire, excuse me. There are definitely chants about Palestinian statehood and from the river to the sea, and thank God we're not in Germany, we're not getting banned for any of that stuff. But I don't think it's more fervently like pro-resistance or anything like that. It's really just a human solidarity. It's quite apolitical, actually. Like I was saying to you earlier, you're seeing people at marches. I've never seen them on a political march for a domestic issue in Ireland ever. I think it's just an understanding when we see oppressed people, war-torn people, particularly people undergoing a man-made mass starvation, it just does something to us in Ireland. It's so familiar in a horrible way, and we feel this kinship. So we're hitting the streets in record numbers. I mean, I'm just from Cork in the south of Ireland, small enough. You know, all these little towns in Cork, there's marches and rallies pretty much every day of the week at this point. So it feels like it's a real movement in Ireland. And I know the Palestinians who are here and who've come here feel like the connection between the two countries is something that kind of means a lot to them. They feel kind of safe here. So I don't think I've ever been so proud to be Irish, to be honest.
Potentially, this is going to be a related question, actually. Ty, we got a question from Phil McElhinney with a super chat. What shirt is that Ty is wearing?
This is a Bohemians jersey. So, Michael, just to give you a bit of context, I'm from Cork. Bohemians are a Dublin team. For me not to be wearing Cork colours is like going to get my head kicked in shortly after this programme ends. But Bohemians are a big pro-Palestine team. And this is a specially designed Palestine jersey. And I did a fundraiser there recently and they gave me this jersey. So I'm kind of a Bose fan now going forward. So I'd like to apologize to the people of Cork. Thank you.
Are you a football fan? So was this a real betrayal for you, or are you sort of someone who, you know, you're only semi into football anyway?
I'm a Cork City fan. And I mean, I wouldn't go to every single game, but like, honestly, look, it's a tiny little thing, but I'm sure Cork City will come on and do, you know, some stuff in the future, but I didn't see many clubs in Ireland being as so pro-Palestine as Bohs and Bohemians, and their ethics are so good. They gave me a jersey and I said, look, the least I can do is wear it. So yeah, shout out to Bohs. I'm going to get my head kicked in.
Let's go to our final story. Gordon Ramsay is famous for losing his temper at underperforming kitchen staff. But this week, he's had a new set of enemies raising his temperature. Squatters. The celebrity chef's North London gastro pub is called the York and Albany, and it's currently up for sale for £13 million. But before the sale could be made, squatters moved in. As the building wasn't long empty, Gordon Ramsay has had no trouble getting a court order to remove the squatters. But right-wingers were still fuming that the police didn't get involved. GB News uploaded a video titled Outrage. Woke cops refused to boot out squatters who took over Gordon Ramsay's pub. Of course, the reason the police didn't get involved isn't because they're woke, but because for hundreds of years in this country, squatting was considered a civil, not a criminal matter. That meant that while a property owner could take squatters to court to get the rights back to their property, occupying an empty building was not itself a crime. Now, in 2012, unfortunately, the very un-British coalition government changed the law for residential property. So it now is a criminal offence to try and occupy a residential building. But squatters still have rights in empty commercial properties. Now, Ramsay's restaurant is very obviously a commercial property. So the cops weren't woke. They just knew the law. So those are the facts. And I thought I'd go on GB News myself to set the record straight. I was up against a gentleman from the Adam Smith Institute who went first.
I can kind of understand in a sort of frontier society like the United States, where, you know, you're out in the outbacks of the Badlands of North Dakota and you're looking for somewhere and you can see an abandoned cabin up ahead and you go and stay there, that sort of thing. That's not what's happening anymore. As you say, these people are kind of professional squatters who are trying to get either to cause a nuisance or to not have to pay rent or things like that, or eventually to try and take private property off of people. We've already seen in Florida recently that Governor Ron DeSantis has seen this has been a problem and boom, he's just on and change the legislation. I think that's excellent. And I'm speaking to you today from the Adam Smith Institute. I've got an Adam Smith quote here. The protection of every individual's property against those who would attempt either by violence or fraud to take it from him is one of the chief tasks of government. I think it's one of the fewest things that government should definitely be doing to protect people's private property from squatters breaking in like this.
Well, there you go. Michael, do you believe in property rights?
In most circumstances, yeah. But I think if you're not using a piece of land, then it goes back very long, a long time into British tradition. We don't have to sort of hypothesize about what might have been the case in the American frontier. Squatters' rights were sort of central to the peasants' revolt, in the 1300s, the diggers in the 1600s, especially actually the peak of squatting in the UK was after the Second World War when you had lots of veterans. You had a big homelessness problem and you had lots of empty buildings. Now, it needs to be understood. I mean, your audience needs to be clear. It's not legal to occupy a building which is in use, right? If you try and occupy a building which is in use, then the police will kick you out. Now, up until 2012, any building that wasn't in use, that was empty on a long-term basis, then people, yes, could go into that building and begin to use it. And it would then be a civil case. So it wouldn't be a criminal case. The owners of the building would have to take you to court. Now, since 2012, I think, unfortunately, the law was changed. And as I say, a law that goes back hundreds of years, the law was changed. So it became a criminal offence to squat.
But Michael, what if you haven't decided yet what to do with it? You know, you own a property. You haven't quite decided whether you want to make it into a bar or you want to sell it or you want to change it into a new restaurant. You can't just expect people to just rock up and nick it.
Well, I mean, historically, the idea of squatting is that you occupy something that's been empty for a long-term basis. So in this situation with Gordon Ramsay, as I understand it, it hadn't been empty for very long at all. And I assume that's why it's been incredibly easy for him to regain possession of it. But you do have buildings which are empty for a very long period of time. And I think in the context where you have a housing crisis, people do have a responsibility to use their buildings properly. Because it's not so much about the bricks and mortar. I'm not really fussed about the bricks and mortar. What I'm fussed about is the land, because land is this incredibly valuable commodity. And you are really staking a claim on a part of a city if you're sitting on an empty property.
Now, the debate went on for another 5 minutes or so, as you can imagine. And I did manage to get my favourite Adam Smith quote in. So I thought this would be good against the Adam Smith Institute. So it's this. As soon as the land of any country has all become private property, the landlords, like all other men, love to reap where they never sowed and demand a rent even for its natural produce. Now, that was part of Adam Smith's argument for a land value tax, which the modern day Adam Smith Institute conveniently seems to have forgotten. Perhaps they're not actually particularly interested in the principles of Adam Smith, but rather in protecting the interests of the powerful. Tig, I want your view on squatting.
Big fan. Well, I suppose like you've got Tory rule for the last however long in Britain. Our version of the Tories is Fine Gael here in Ireland. So the big thing with let the market sort it out rule is that you end up with all these kind of dilapidated places, certainly in Ireland, and I know it's the same over there, empty buildings. And also the main thing is that people can't afford to live in our cities anymore. Like even if you look at the arts in Dublin, for instance, I don't really have any friends who work in the arts that are left living in Dublin unless they're somehow, you know, independently wealthy or their parents give them money. So like the whole cultural centre of the city in Dublin, for instance, has just been removed from government policies, which is just like let the market dictate, the market will sort it all out, and it never, ever, ever does. So, yeah, I mean, we're just going to see more and more of it. I mean, if it's a political action on behalf of the squatters, I'd say power to them. It's a, you know, they're making a great statement. And if they've accidentally just wandered into Gordon Ramsay's premises, I probably feel sorry for them. Although I would say Gordon Ramsay and the squatters would make an infinitely more interesting reality TV show than any of his restaurant shows, in my opinion. I think it could be pretty good.
Yeah, I think he's missed a trick there. Him going in and sort of shouting at them and them saying, we're not breaking the law. And then the police coming and the police not sort of intervening. And then Gordon Ramsay swearing at the cops. And them arresting Gordon Ramsay for swearing at the cops. It could have been a really good sketch.
It's good, man. Good.
I want to sort of come back to this point about culture, because before I went on GB News sort of earlier today, I was sort of thinking of the different angles that might come up. And I do think the culture one is really important, because people often complain nowadays that sort of like new actors that come up, new comedians that come up, new pop stars that come up, everyone seems kind of posh. And I think probably one of the big reasons is that it's very difficult, unless you're from London, unless you're wealthy, it's very difficult to move to London or Manchester or any kind of big city where you can get into the cultural industries. And it was the case for so much of, I suppose, especially the second half of the 20th century, where if you wanted to sort of make a name for yourself in the arts, then squatting in a major city was one of the main options. I got, Richard Branson, not even cultural, he squatted for a while. Mark Knopfler, is he from Dire Straits? Bob Geldof, Joe Strummer of The Clash spent much of the 70s in a London squat. Harry Enfield, Charlie Higson and Paul Whitehouse met in squat. So you wouldn't have the Fast Show without squatting. Now, all of these people wouldn't have been able to squat in this day and age. I mean, maybe if they'd found, you know, one of the few empty commercial buildings, but it used to be the case that any empty building you could squat. And so loads of, you know, people you've heard of would have squatted. And if they hadn't been able to sort of move to London in that situation, we might never have seen them. Is squatting a thing in Ireland? Is it legal?
No, we'd have a big tradition of squatting in London, as you say. So like in the 70s and 80s and 90s in Ireland, people emigrating, going to London to squat. And then you get all these Irish, you know, communities in Britain and forming bands and getting drunk and having crack and stuff like. But it's not such a mad big thing here. Occupying buildings, we went through a period of, you know, during the Occupy kind of stage there, we did a bit of that. But who knows what's ahead, because there's a housing crisis in Ireland like you wouldn't believe. It's getting worse and worse, and I'm repeating myself now, but it's all government policy, you know, like they like to make you feel like it's this kind of natural disaster, but it's what happens when you let the market dictate and people have got nowhere to live. They're getting angrier and angrier, and I think squatting is going to be that's going to be a small drop in the ocean as to what, you know, social problems are ahead for people who can't afford to live in the city that they grew up in.
Is sort of Dublin full of big empty buildings, or is it sort of, because I feel like in a way Ireland just doesn't have enough houses, although I suppose you did build a lot in the 2008 boom. What's going on there? Enlighten me.
The housing crisis in 1 minute. Okay, here we go. So yeah, there are loads of empty buildings, but we've also put like a massive emphasis on hotels. If you go to Dublin now, you turn a corner, there's a hotel on the way up. So it's become this real commercial capital. It's overpriced. It's crazy, crazy expensive. And as I say, the most important thing, in my humble opinion, is that the artistic life of the city has been sucked out. So I don't think many people are going to Dublin to see hotels. They're going to experience Irish culture and art and whatnot, and all the artists are gone. So they've completely shot themselves in the foot by having this kind of corporatist commercial mentality. But that's Fine Gael for any of your listeners. That's our Tories. So hopefully at the next election, we're going to have a left-leaning government in, and we got some hope with those guys. But yeah, I'd recommend any of your listeners to boycott Dublin and come straight to Cork, or go to Belfast, far superior cities.
Okay, that's the end of my quick fire round of random questions about Irish politics and social policy. So thank you for responding to those and indulging me. Tig, it's been really great having you on the show. We'll definitely get you back soon. The comments are so positive on YouTube. So it's been a real pleasure having you on.
Thanks, brother. Absolute pleasure. Anytime. Loved it.
And thanks to all of you at home for tuning in. Make sure to come back tomorrow for another stream from 6 p.m. You've been watching Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com /support.